unfolded the glasses, slid them onto her face. Carefully, Miss Lula studied each license, giving each girl her undivided attention. "This one," she said, holding out the license for Catherine Treadwell. "This is Kitty, but I assume you know that by her name." Amanda said, "We've been led to believe that Kitty was renting out the space to the other girls." "Yes, that would make sense." "Did you ever talk to her?"
"Once." "She seemed to think very highly of herself. Apparently her father is very politically connected."
"She said that to you?" Evelyn asked. "Kitty told you who her father was?"
"Not in so many words, but yes, she made it clear she didn't really belong here, but then, do any of us?"
Amanda couldn't answer the question. "Do the other girls look familiar?"
The woman scanned the licenses again. She held up Jane Delray's.
"The quality of men changed quite a bit for this one. She was not as discriminating as..."
She held up Mary Halston's photo.
"This one had a lot of repeat customers, though I would not call them gentlemen. She's the girl out back." She read the name. "Donna Mary Halston." "Such a pretty name, considering the thing she did."
Amanda heard Evelyn suck in her breath. They were both thinking of the same question. Amanda asked,
"You said Mary had repeat business."
"Yes, that's correct."
"Did you ever see a white man who was about 6 feet tall, sandy blonde hair, long sideburns, wearing a sharply tailored suit, probably in some shade of blue?"
Miss Lula glanced at Dina. When she handed back the licenses to Amanda, her expression was blank.
"I'll have to think on that. Let me get back to you tomorrow."
Amanda felt her brow furrow. Either the wine was wearing off or the tea was kicking in. Miss Lula's apartment was at the end of the hallway. It was at least 10 yards from the stairwell, even farther from the back door. Unless the old woman spent her days sitting behind the building, there was no way she could note the comings and goings of the girls or their visitors. Amanda opened her mouth to speak, but Dina interrupted her.
"Miss Lula," she said, "we appreciate your time. You've got my number. Get back to me on that question."
She put her saucer down on the tray. When Evelyn and Amanda didn't move, she grabbed their teacups and placed them beside hers.
"We can let ourselves out."
She did everything but clap her hands to get them moving. Amanda led the way, clutching her purse to her chest. She was going to turn to say goodbye, but Dina pushed them out the door. The hallway had emptied. Still, Amanda kept her voice low.
"How could she?" "Give her until tomorrow," Dina said. "She'll find out whether or not your mystery man was here."
"But how could she?"
"She's the queen bee," Dina told her, leading them up the hallway.
She didn't stop until she reached the exit door. They stood in the same spot where Rick Landry had threatened Evelyn.
"What Miss Lula told you isn't what she's seen. It's what she's heard."
"But she didn't..."
"Rule number one of the ghetto, find the oldest biddy been around the longest. She's the one running the place."
"Well," Evelyn said, "I did wonder why she had a shotgun under the couch."
Amanda asked, "What?"
"That thing was loaded, too."
Dina pushed open the door. The crime scene was cordoned off with yellow tape. There were no lights back here, or at least no lights that were functioning. The bulbs on the light poles had all been broken, probably with rocks. 6 patrolmen took care of the problem. They stood in a ring around the body, the butts of their Kell lights resting on their shoulders to illuminate the area. The grounds behind the building were as desolate as the front. Red Georgia clay was packed hard by the constant pounding of bare feet. There were no flowers back here, no grass. One lone tree stood with its tired branches hanging down. Just below the tree was the body. Pete Hansen blocked the view with his wide frame. Beside him was a young man of about the same height and stature. Like Pete, he was wearing a white lab coat. He tapped Pete on the shoulder and nodded toward the women. Pete stood up. He had a grim look on his face.
"Detectives, I'm glad you're here, though I say that with reservations, given the circumstances."
He indicated the young man.
"This is one of my pupils, Dr. Ned Taylor."
Taylor gave them a stern nod. Even in the low illumination, Amanda could see the green tint to his skin. He looked as if he might be ill. Evelyn wasn't much better. Dina suggested,
"Pete, why don't you run Amanda through this?"
Amanda supposed she should feel proud of her lack of squeamishness, but it was starting to feel like one more secret she would have to keep about herself. Evelyn volunteered,
"I'll go check the apartment. Maybe Butch and Landry missed something."
Dina harumphed.
"I'd bet my next paycheck on it." "This way, my dear."
Pete cupped his hand beneath Amanda's elbow as he led her toward the dead woman. The six officers holding flashlights seemed puzzled that Amanda was there, though none of them asked questions, probably in deference to Pete.
"If you would."
Pete got down on one knee, then helped Amanda kneel beside him. She smoothed down her skirt so that her knees would not grind against the dirt. Her heels were going to get scuffed. She hadn't exactly dressed for this.
Pete said, "Tell me what you see."
The victim was face down, her long blonde hair draped down her shoulders and back. She was wearing a black miniskirt and red t-shirt. Her hand rested on the ground a few inches from her face. The nails were polished bright red.
Amanda said, "Same as the other victim. All 10 fingernails expertly manicured."
"Correct." Pete pulled back the woman's stringy blonde hair.
"Neck's bruised, though I'm going to guess the hyoid wasn't broken."
"She wasn't strangled to death?"
"I believe there's something else going on."
He pulled up the red t-shirt. There was a line of injuries down the woman's side, almost like a dress seam had been ripped open.
"These lacerations run the length of her body."
Amanda saw the pattern duplicated on the girl's leg. She had mistaken the damage for the seam in a pair of stockings. Likewise, the outside of the victim's arms showed the marks. It was like a McCall's pattern, where someone had tried to tear apart the stitches joining the front to the back of her body. Amanda asked,
"What? Who would do that?"
"Two very good questions. Unfortunately, my answer to both is that I have no idea."
Amanda didn't so much ask as wonder aloud.
"You told Dina to call us, to get us here."
"Yes, the manicured fingernails were similar. The setting, I thought there was more, but upon further examination..."
He started to pull up the miniskirt, then changed his mind.
"I must warn you, even I was startled. I haven't seen this in a few years."
Amanda shook her head.
"What do you mean?"
He pulled up the skirt. There was a knitting needle between the girl's legs. Amanda didn't need to be coached this time. Automatically, she found herself taking deep breaths, filling her lungs, then slowly pushing out all the air.
Pete shook his head. "There's absolutely no reason for a girl to have to do this anymore,"
Amanda noticed.
"There's no blood."
Pete sat back on his heels.
"No, there's not."
"You would expect to see blood, wouldn't you? From the knitting needle?"
"Yes."
Pete pushed open the legs. One of the officers moved back a step. He nearly tripped over a broken tree limb. There were a couple of nervous laughs, but the man righted himself without incident. He trained the beam of his flashlight on the victim's legs. Pasty white thighs, no blood. Amanda asked,
"Are her fingerprints on the knitting needle?"
Despite the circumstances, Pete smiled at her.
"None. It was wiped clean."
"She didn't do this to herself."
"Not likely. She's been cleaned up. Someone brought her here."
"The same place our other victim was found."
"Not exactly, but close."
He pointed to a spot several feet away.
"Lucy Bennett was found over there."
Amanda looked back up at the building. Miss Lula's apartment was on the far end. she couldn't see the tree from her window. She certainly couldn't see where Jane Delray was found. Dina was right. There was someone else, or a series of someone else's, who'd seen everything but were too afraid to tell.
"Ned," Pete called, "take her feet. I'll get her shoulders."
The young doctor did as he was instructed. Carefully, they rolled the victim over onto her back. Amanda looked at the girl's face. The damage was incomprehensible. Her eyelids were shredded. Her mouth was torn to pieces. Still, there was enough left to recognize her. Amanda unzipped her purse and found the license, which she handed to Pete.
"Donna Marie Halston," he read. "Lives here?"
He looked up at the building.
"Top floor, I'm assuming. Same as Lucy Bennett."
Amanda shuffled through the licenses and found Lucy Bennett's. She handed this to Pete and waited. He studied the photo carefully. He was obviously mindful of the six patrolmen when he told Amanda, "This girl is unfamiliar to me." Amanda handed him Jane Delray's license. Again, he studied the photo. A deep sigh came out like a groan.
"Yes, this one I recognize."
He handed both licenses back to Amanda.
"Now what?"
She shook her head. It felt good to have Pete weigh in on the identities, but his validation wasn't going to change much. The back door opened. Evelyn shook her head. "Nothing in the apartment. It's still a mess, but I don't think anyone's..." She stopped. Amanda followed her gaze to the knitting needle. Evelyn put her hand to her mouth. Instead of turning away, she looked up at the tree. Then she looked down at the girl again.
"What is it?" Amanda asked. Something was obviously wrong.
She stood up and joined Evelyn. It was the same as the construction paper puzzle. Sometimes a change in perspective was all it took. The tree limb was broken. The girl lay on the ground. Her child had been aborted.
"Oh, my God,"
Amanda realized. "Ophelia." 19. Present Day. Susanna Ford. The darkness, the cold, the noise. Air sucking in and out like a car zooming through a tunnel. She couldn't take it anymore. Her body ached. Her mouth was dry. Her stomach was so empty that she felt as if the acids were eating a hole in her belly. Meth. That was what had brought her here. Brought her low. She had fallen too far. She had put herself in the gutter. She had brought herself to this place.
"Dear Jesus," she prayed, "if you get me out of here, I will worship you every day. I will exalt your name."
The claustrophobia, the absolute darkness, the unknowing, the fear of suffocation. Way back when they were still a family, her father had taken them all on a trip to Wales. There was a mine there, something from thousands of years ago. You had to wear a hard hat to go into the tunnels. They were small because people weren't as tall back then. They were narrow because most of the workers were children. Susanna had gone in 20 feet before she started freaking out. She could still see sunlight from the opening, but she'd nearly pissed herself running back toward the entrance. That was what it felt like now. Trapped. Hopeless.
"I will praise you. I will spread your word. I will humble myself before you."
Arms couldn't move. Legs couldn't move. Eyes couldn't open. Mouth couldn't open.
"Meth will never touch my lips, my nose, my lungs ever again, so help me God."
The tremble started slow, coursing through her body, straining her muscles. Her fingers flexed into a fist. She clenched her shoulders, her teeth, her ass. The threads pulled. The pain was excruciating. Hot needles touching raw nerves. Her heart was going to explode in her chest.
She could rip herself away. She was stronger than this. She could rip herself away.
Susanna tried. She tried so hard. But each time, the pain won. She couldn't make the skin tear. She couldn't make the thread break. She could only lie there, praying for salvation. Dear Jesus.
20. Present day. Tuesday. Will awoke with a start. His neck cracked as he stretched it side to side. He was at home, sitting on his couch. Betty was beside him. The little dog was on her back, legs up, nose pointed toward the front door. Will glanced around, looking for Faith. She'd driven him home from the morgue. She'd gone to get him a glass of water, and now, judging by the clock on the TiVo, it was almost 2 hours later. He listened to the house. It was quiet. Faith had left. Will didn't know how he felt about that. Should he be relieved? Should he wonder where she had gone? There was no guidebook for this part of his life. No instructions he could follow to put it all back together. He tried to close his eyes again, to go back to sleep. He wanted to wake up a year from now. He wanted to wake up and have all of this over. Only he couldn't get his eyes to stay closed. Every time he tried, he found himself staring back up at the ceiling. Was that what it had been like for his mother? According to the autopsy report, her eyes had not always been sewn closed. Sometimes they had been sewn open. The medical examiner posited in the report that Will's father would have to stay close by during these periods. He would have to use a dropper to keep her eyes from drying out. Dr. Edward Taylor. That was the name of the medical examiner. The man had died in a car accident 15 years ago. He'd been the first investigator Will had tried to track down. The first dead end. The first time Will had felt relief that there was no one around to explain to him exactly what had happened to his mother. Hey, Faith came out of his spare bedroom. He could see that the light was still on. His books were in there. All his CDs, car magazines he'd collected over the years, albums from way back. It had probably taken Faith less than 10 seconds to figure out which items were most out of place. She held the books in her hand. The New Feminist Hegemony. Applied Statistical Models, Theory and Application. A Vindication of the Rights of Women. He said, "You can go home now." "I'm not leaving you alone." She put his mother's textbooks on the table as she sat in the recliner. The file was on the table, too. Will had left it there this morning. Faith had probably paged through everything while he was sleeping. He should have felt angry that she'd been prying, but there was nothing left inside of him. Will was utterly devoid of any emotion. He'd felt it happen when he first saw Sarah at the morgue. His initial impulse was to weep at her feet, to tell her everything, to beg her to understand. And then, nothing. It was like a stopper being pulled. All of the feeling had just drained out of him. The rest flashed in his mind like a movie preview that gave away every plot twist. The battered girl, the painted fingernails, the ripped skin, the sound of Sarah's breath catching when Will told her, told everyone, that his father was to blame. Sarah was a verbal woman, outspoken at times, and not usually one to hold back her opinion. But in the end, she'd said nothing. After nearly 2 weeks of living with that inquisitive look in her eyes, there were no questions she wanted to ask. Nothing she wanted to know. It was all laid out in front of her. Amanda was right about the autopsy. Will shouldn't have been there. It had been like watching his mother being examined, processed, catalogued.
And Angie was right about Sarah. It was too much for her to handle. Why had he thought for even a second that Angie was wrong? Why had he thought Sarah would be different? Will had just stood there in the morgue, frozen in time and place, staring at Sarah, waiting for her to speak, waiting for her to scream or yell or throw something. He would probably still be there but for Amanda ordering Faith to take him home. Even then, Faith had to grab Will's arm and physically pull him from the room. Close up on Sarah, her face pale, her head shaking. Fade to black. The end. "Will?" Faith asked. He looked up at her. "How did you get into the GBI?" He weighed the question, trying to spot her endgame.
"I was recruited."
"How?"
"Amanda came to my college."
Faith gave a tight nod, and he could tell she was chasing a train of thought he couldn't pin down. "What about the application?" Will rubbed his eyes. There was still white grit in the corners from tearing apart the basement. Faith pressed. "The background screening, all the paperwork." She knew about his dyslexia. She also knew he could pull his own weight.
"It was mostly oral interviews. They let me take the rest home. Same as you, right?"
Faith's chin tilted up. Finally, she said, "Right." Will rested his hand on Betty's chest. He could feel her heartbeat against his palm. She sighed. Her tongue licked out. Will asked,
"Why did the reporter from the Atlanta Journal call Amanda?"
Faith shrugged. "Don't worry about it. I told you I shut down the story." Will had been so blind. Amanda had fed him the information this morning, but he'd been too exhausted to process it.
"My records are sealed. There is no way a reporter or anybody could know who my father is, at least not legally."
He studied Faith.
"And even if someone found out, why call Amanda? Why not call me directly? My number is listed. So's my address."
Faith chewed her bottom lip. It was her tell. She knew something that Will did not, and she wasn't going to share it. Will leaned toward her.
"I want you to go to the hotel. He's on parole. He doesn't have a legal expectation of privacy."
Faith didn't need to ask whose hotel room. "And do what?" Will clenched his fist. The cuts opened up again.
"I want you to toss his room. I want you to interrogate him and sit on him until he can't take it anymore."
Faith stared at him. "You know I can't do that."
"Why not?"
"Because we have to build a case, not a harassment suit."
"I don't care about a case. Make him so miserable he leaves the hotel just to get away from you."
"And then what?" She knew what would happen next. Will would shoot him down in the street like a rabid dog. She said, "I'm not going to do that."
"I can look up the layout of the hotel. I can go to the courthouse. I can find a way in there and..."
"That sounds like a great way to leave a paper trail." Will didn't care about a paper trail.
"How many men are on the hotel?"
5 times as many as are sitting outside your house right now." Will went to the front window. He pushed open the blinds. There was an Atlanta cop car blocking his driveway. A G-Ride was in the street. Will slammed his hand against the blinds. Betty barked, jumping up from the couch. He went to the back of the house. He opened the kitchen door. A man was sitting in the gazebo Will had built last summer. Tan and blue GBI regs. Glock on his hip. He had his feet propped up on the railing. He waved as Will slammed the door.
"She can't do this," Will said. "She can't sit on my house like I'm some kind of criminal."
Faith asked, "Why didn't you ever tell me about him?" Will paced across the room. His body was suddenly filled with adrenaline.
"So I can be another notch in your serial killer collection?
Do you really think I'd turn your life into a game?"
"Where's my gun?"
His keys were on his desk. His phone, the Glock, was missing.
"Did you take my gun?"
Faith didn't answer, but he noticed that her thigh holster was gone. She'd locked her gun in the car. She didn't trust him not to take it. Several thoughts came into Will's head. Punching a hole in the wall, kicking over his desk, breaking the windows in Faith's car, taking a bat to that asshole sitting in his gazebo. In the end, Will could only stand there. It was the same thing that had happened at the morgue. He was too exhausted, too overwhelmed, too handled. "Just leave, Faith. I don't need you babysitting me. I don't want you here." "Too bad." "Go home. Go home to your stupid kid and get the hell out of my business." "If you think being a dick is going to chase me away, you don't know me very well." She sat back in the chair, arms crossed over her chest. Sarah found semen in the girl's hair. Will waited for her to continue. "There's enough for a DNA profile. Once it's in the system, we can match it against his." "That'll take weeks."
4 days, she told him. Dr. Coolidge put a rush on it.
"Then arrest him. You can hold him for 24 hours.
Which means he'll bail out and disappear before we can pick him up again." Her voice had the annoying tone of someone trying to be reasonable. "APD put 6 guys on the hotel. Amanda probably has 10 more. He won't be able to take a shit without us knowing."
"I want to be there when you arrest him."
"You know Amanda won't allow that."
"When you interrogate him."
Will couldn't help himself. He started begging.
"Please let me see him, please. I have to see him. I want to look him in the eye. I want to see his face when he realizes that I got away, that he didn't win."
Faith put her hand over her heart. "I swear to God, Will. I swear to you on the lives of my children that I will do everything in my power to make sure that happens."
"It's not enough,"
Will said. He didn't just want to look his father in the eye. He wanted to beat him. He wanted to kick out his teeth, to slice off his cock, to sew shut his mouth and eyes and nose and beat him until he drowned in his own vomit.
"It's not enough."
"I know it's not," Faith said. "It'll never be enough, but it'll have to do." There was a knock on the door. Will didn't know who he was expecting when Faith opened the door. Amanda, Angie, some cop telling him that Will's father had killed again. Anyone but the person who was actually there. Sarah asked Faith, "Everything okay?" Faith nodded, picking up her purse by the door. She told Will, "I'll call you the minute I know anything. I promise." Sarah shut the door behind her. Her hair fell in soft curls around her shoulders. She was wearing a tight black dress that wrapped around her body. Will had seen her dressed up before, but never like this. She was wearing extremely high heels with a black leopard print. They did something to her calf that sent a tightness into his groin. She said, "Hi." Will swallowed. He could still taste plaster in his throat. Sarah walked around the couch and sat down. She slid off her heels and tucked her legs underneath. "Come here." Will sat down on the couch. Betty was between them. She jumped down. Her toenails clicked across the floor as she headed into the kitchen. Sarah took his hand. She must have noticed the cuts and blisters, but she didn't say anything. Will couldn't look at her. She was so beautiful that it was almost painful. Instead, he stared at the coffee table, his mother's file, her books. He said, "I guess Amanda told you everything."
"No, she didn't."
Will wasn't surprised. Amanda loved torturing him. He pointed to his mother's things.
"If you want to."
Will stopped, trying to keep his voice from cracking.
"It's all there. Just go ahead and read it."
Sarah glanced down at the file but said, "I don't want to read it." Will shook his head. He didn't understand.
"You tell me about her when you're ready." It would be easier if...
She reached out to touch his face. Her fingers stroked his cheek. She moved closer. He felt the heat of her body as she pressed against him. Will put his hand on her leg, felt the firm muscle of her thigh. The tightness came back. He kissed her. Sarah's hands went to his face as she kissed him back. She straddled him, her hair draped across his face. He could feel her breath on his neck. Unfortunately, that was the extent of his feelings. She asked,
"Do you want me to?"
"No." He pulled her back up.
"I'm sorry. I'm..."
She put her fingers to his lips.
"You know what I really want to do?"
She climbed off him, but stayed close. "I want to watch a movie where robots hit each other. Or things blow up. Preferably from robots hitting each other." She picked up the remote and turned on the set. She tuned in the speed channel. "Oh, look, this is even better." Will could not think of a time in his life when he'd felt more miserable. If Faith had not taken his Glock, he would have shot himself in the head.
"Sarah, it's not..."
"Shh." Sarah took his arm and wrapped it around her shoulder. She rested her head on his chest, her hand on his leg. Betty came back. She jumped into Will's lap and settled in. He stared at the television. The Ferrari Enzo was being profiled. An Italian man was using a lathe to hollow out a piece of aluminum. Nothing the announcer said would stay in Will's head. He felt his eyelids getting heavy. He let out a slow breath. Finally, his eyes stayed closed. This time, when Will woke up, he wasn't alone. Sarah was lying on the couch in front of him, her back curved into his body. Her hair tickled his face. The room was dark except for the glow of the television set. The sound was muted. Speed was showing a monster truck rally. The TiVo read 12 past midnight. Another day passed. Another night come. Another page turned in the calendar of his father's life. Will couldn't stop the thoughts that came into his head. He wondered if Faith still had his Glock. He wondered whether the patrol car was still blocking his driveway or the asshole was still in his gazebo. He had a Sig Sauer in the gun safe that was bolted inside his closet. His Colt AR-15 rifle was disassembled beside it. Ammunition for both was stacked in a plastic box. Will worked the rifle in his mind. Magazine, bolt catch, trigger guard. Winchester 55 grain full metal jacket. No. The Sig would be better. Closer, muzzled ahead, finger on the trigger. Will would see the terror in his father's eyes. Then the glassy, vacant stare of a dead man. Sarah stirred. Her hand snaked back and stroked the side of his face. Her fingernails lightly scratched the skin. She breathed a contented sigh. Just like that, Will felt the anger start to drain away. Again, it was similar to what had happened at the morgue. But instead of feeling empty, he felt full. A calmness took over. The clamp around his chest started to loosen. Sarah leaned back into him. Her hand pulled him closer. Will's body was much more responsive this time. He pressed his mouth to her neck. The fine hairs stood at attention. He could feel her flesh prickle under his tongue. Sarah turned her head to look at him. She gave a sleepy smile.
"Hey. Hey. I was hoping that was you."
He kissed her mouth. She turned to face him. She was still smiling. Will could feel the curve of her lips against his mouth. Her hair was tangled underneath her. He shifted and felt a sharp pain in his leg. It wasn't a pulled muscle,
It was Angie's ring. He still had it in his pocket. Sarah mistook his reaction for a recurrence of his earlier problem. She said, "Let's play a game." Will didn't need a game. He needed to get Angie out of his head, but that wasn't exactly news he could share. She held out her hand. "I'm Sarah."
"I know."
"No," she still had her hand out. "I'm Sarah Linton." And apparently, Will was a moron. He shook her hand.
"Will Trent."
"What do you do for a living, Will Trent?"
"I'm a..."
He glanced around for an idea.
"I'm a monster truck driver."
She looked at the TV and laughed.
"That's creative." "What are you?"
"A stripper." She laughed again, as if she'd shocked herself. "I'm only doing it to pay my way through college." If Will's stupid wedding ring wasn't in his front pocket, he could have invited Sarah to slip her hand inside to get some money for a lap dance. Instead, he had to settle on telling her,
"That's commendable."
He shifted onto his side, freeing up his hand.
"What are you studying?"
She grinned. "Monster truck repair." He trailed his finger between her breasts. The dress was low-cut, designed in such a way that it opened with little effort. Will realized she had worn it for him, just like she'd let her hair down. Just like she'd squeezed her feet into a pair of high-heel shoes that could probably break her toes. Just like she'd been at the autopsy. Just like she was here now. He said,
"I'm actually not a monster truck driver."
"No?" Her breath caught as he tickled his fingers down her bare stomach. "What are you?"
"I'm an ex-con."
"Oh, I like that," she said. "Jewel thief or bank robber?"
"Petty theft. Destruction of private property, 4-year suspended sentence."
Her laughter stopped. She could tell he wasn't playing anymore. Will took in a deep breath and slowly let it go.
He was doing this now.
There was no going back.
"I was arrested for stealing food."
He had to clear his throat so the words could get out.
"It happened when I was 18.
She put her hand over his.
"I aged out of the system."
Mrs. Flanagan had died the summer Will's 18th birthday rolled around. The new guy who ran the home had given Will $100 and a map to the homeless shelter.
"I ended up at the downtown mission. Some of the guys there were all right. Most of them were older and..."
He didn't finish the sentence. Sarah could easily guess why a teenager didn't feel safe there.
"I lived on the streets."
Again, he let his voice trail off.
"I hung out at the hardware store on Highland. Contractors used to go there in the mornings to pick up day workers."
She used her thumb to stroke the back of his hand. "Is that where you learned how to fix things?"
"Yeah."
He'd never really thought about it, but it was true.
"I made good money, but I didn't know how to spend it. I should have saved up for an apartment or a car or something. But I spent it on candy and a Walkman and tapes."
Will had never had money in his pocket before. There was no such thing as an allowance when he was growing up.
"I was sleeping on Peachtree where the library used to be. This group of older guys rolled me. They beat me down, broke my nose, some of my fingers. Took everything I had. I'm guess I'm lucky that's all they did."
Sarah's grip tightened around his hand.
"I couldn't work. My clothes were filthy. I didn't have anywhere to bathe. I tried to beg for money, but people were scared of me. I guess I looked like a junkie."
He told Sarah,
"I wasn't, though. I never did drugs. I never did any of those things."
She nodded.
"But I was so hungry. My stomach hurt all the time. I was dizzy from it. Sick. Afraid to go to sleep. Afraid I'd get rolled again. I went into this all-night pharmacy that used to be on Ponce de Leon, Plaza Drugs, right beside the movie theater."
Sarah nodded.
I walked straight in and started taking food off the shelves. Little Debbie's, moon pies, anything with a wrapper. I tore it open with my teeth and shoved it into my mouth. He swallowed, his throat feeling raw. They called the cops.
They arrested you.
They tried. He felt shame welling up in his throat. I started swinging my fists, trying to hit anything. They stopped me real fast.
Sarah stroked back his hair with her fingers.
They handcuffed me, took me to jail. And then, he shook his head. My caseworker came in. I hadn't seen her in 6, maybe 7 months. She said she'd been looking for me.
Why?
Because Mrs. Flanagan left me some money.
Will still remembered his shock when he heard the news.
I was only allowed to use it for college. So?
He shrugged.
I went to the first college that would take me. Lived in the dorm, ate in the cafeteria, worked a part-time job on the grounds. And then I got recruited into the GBI. And that was it.
Sarah was quiet, probably trying to absorb it all. How did you pass the background check?
The judge said she would expunge my record if I graduated from college. Fortunately, the woman hadn't specified anything about his grades. So I did, and she did.
Sarah was quiet again.
I know, it's bad.
He laughed at the irony.
I guess in the scheme of things, it's not the worst thing you've heard about me today.
You were lucky you got arrested.
I guess.
And I'm lucky that you got into the GBI, because I never would have met you otherwise.
I'm sorry, Sarah. I'm sorry I brought this all down on you. I don't...
He felt the words getting jumbled up in his mouth.
I don't want you to be scared of me. I don't want you to think that I'm anything like him.
Of course you're not. She wrapped her hand around his. Don't you know that I'm in awe of you? Will could only look at her. What you've been through? What you've endured? The man you've become? She placed his hand over her heart. You chose to be a good person. You chose to help other people. It would have been so easy to go down the wrong path, but at every step, you chose to do the right thing.
Not always.
Often enough, she said. Often enough so that when I look at you, all I can think about is how good you are. How much I want you, need you in my life. Her eyes were a clear green in the glow of the television. Will couldn't believe that she was still there beside him. Still wanted to be with him. Angie had been so wrong. There was no guile inside of Sarah. No meanness. No spite. If he were truly a good man, he would have told Sarah about Angie. He would have confessed and gotten it over with. Instead, Will kissed her. He kissed her eyelids and her nose and her mouth. Their tongues touched. Will moved on top of her. Sarah's leg wrapped around his. She deepened the kiss. Will felt the guilt slip away easily. Too easily. All that he could think about was his desire, his need to be inside of her. He felt almost frantic as he started to undress her. Sarah helped him with her clothes. He ended up tearing the dress. She was wearing a lacy black bra that easily unclasped. Will kissed her breasts, used his tongue and teeth until she let out a deep moan. He traced his tongue down, biting and kissing the smooth skin. Sarah gasped when he pulled down her underwear and pushed apart her legs. She tasted like honey and copper pennies. Her thigh rubbed against his face. Her fingernails dug into his scalp. She pulled him back up and started kissing him again, sucking his tongue, doing things with her mouth that made him start to shake. Will pushed himself inside of her. She moaned again. She gripped his back. Will forced himself to go slow. Sarah took him in deeper with each thrust. Her lips brushed his ear.
My love, she breathed. My love.
21. July 15th, 1975. Lucy Bennett. The contraction started with the sunrise. He'd cut open her eyes, but not her mouth. Lucy could feel the thread tugging her lips as she groaned from the pain. Her arms and legs were spread open, her body aligned straight down the center of the mattress. She had already ripped away her right shoulder. Just a few inches, but it was enough. The shock of being able to move had, at first, dulled the pain. Now the flesh throbbed. Blood trickled down her arm and chest, pooled beneath her shoulder blade. Another contraction started to build, slow, slow, slow. And then it erupted, and Lucy felt her lips start to tear apart as she screamed in agony. Shut up! Someone hissed. The girl in the room next door. She had spoken. The floor creaked beneath her feet as she walked to the closed door. Shut up, she repeated. The other girl had learned. She was compliant. She was welcoming. She talked to the man, prayed with him, screamed and thrashed and grunted with him. In a child's voice, she suggested he do things that Lucy had not even considered. And for that, he let her off her leash sometimes. Like now. She was talking, walking, moving around. She could leave at any time. Run to get help. Run to the police or her family or anywhere but here. But she didn't. The other girl was a regular Patty Hearst. Lucy's replacement. 22. July 15th, 1975. Amanda sat in a back booth at the Majestic Diner on Ponce de Leon. She stifled a yawn. After leaving Techwood last night, she was too wired to sleep. Even Mary Wollstonecraft couldn't send her off. She'd tossed and turned. Images of the construction paper puzzle seemingly burned into her retinas. She'd added the new details in her mind. Hank Bennett, liar. Trey Callahan, liar. And Ophelia. What to make of Ophelia? The waitress refilled Amanda's cup. She looked at her watch. Evelyn was 15 minutes late, which was troubling. Amanda had never known her to be tardy. She'd used the payphone in the back to call the Model City precinct, but no one had answered the phone. Amanda's own roll call had ended almost half an hour ago. She was assigned to Vanessa today, which suited them both. The other woman had decided to treat herself to a day of shopping. That new credit card was burning a hole in her pocketbook. The door opened, and Evelyn rushed in. Sorry, she apologized. I had the strangest call from Hodge. My Hodge? Evelyn waved away the waitress, who came to take her order. He had dispatch send me to Zone 1.
Did anyone see you?
No, the station was empty. It was just me and Hodge and his open door. She sat back against the booth. She was obviously flustered. He wanted me to tell him everything we've been doing. Amanda felt panic start to build. It's okay, he wasn't mad. At least, I don't think he was mad. Who knows with that man? You're absolutely right about his inscrutability. It's unnerving.
Did he say anything?
Nothing. No criticisms, no comments. He just nodded and then told me to go do my job.
That's the same thing he told me yesterday. To do my job.
Amanda asked,
Do you think he was comparing our stories?
Could be.
You didn't hold anything back?
Well, I kept Dina's name out of it. And Miss Lula's. I don't want either of them getting into trouble.
You told him about Ophelia?
No. She admitted. I told him we were going to circle back on Trey Callahan, but I didn't tell him why. Luther Hodge doesn't strike me as a devotee of William Shakespeare.
I don't know about that myself, Evelyn. Maybe we're leaping to conclusions.
Trey Callahan quotes a line from Hamlet, and then you and I see the victim last night and fill in the blanks. It smacks of too much coincidence.
Is there really such a thing as coincidence in police work?
Amanda couldn't answer her.
Do you think Hodge will make trouble for us?
Who the hell knows? She threw her hands into the air. We should get to the mission. Going over it with Hodge again made me think of some things.
Amanda slid out of the booth. She left 2 quarters on the table for the coffee and a generous tip.
Like what?
Like everything.
Evelyn waited until they were outside to speak.
This Hank Bennett situation. I think you're right. I think he's a snake in the grass, and he used the information he had about Kitty Treadwell to get a job with her father.
They got into Amanda's car. She asked,
"How would Bennett know there was a relation?"
Her name was on the apartment door.
Evelyn reminded her.
Even without that, Kitty had a big mouth about her father. Miss Lula knew she was politically connected. Juice knew, too. He even mentioned another sister who was the golden child. It was an open secret on the street.
But not higher up the social ladder, Amanda assumed.
Andrew Treadwell's a Georgia graduate. I remember reading that in the newspaper.
Evelyn smiled.
Hank Bennett was wearing a UGA class ring.
Georgia Bulldogs class of 1974.
Once again, Amanda pulled out onto Ponce de Leon Avenue.
They could have met at a mixer or a social. All those frat boys are thick as thieves.
She'd interviewed her share for the sex crimes unit. They lied like carpets.
What's going on there?
Evelyn pointed at the Union Mission. An APD squad car blocked the entrance.
I have no idea.
Amanda pulled onto the sidewalk and got out of the car. She recognized the patrolman walking out of the building, though she didn't know his name. He obviously knew both Amanda and Evelyn. His pace quickened as he headed toward his car.
"Excuse me,"
Amanda tried, but it was too late. The man got into his cruiser. Rubber squealed against asphalt as he peeled off.
"And the beat goes on," Evelyn said.
She didn't seem too daunted as she headed toward the mission entrance. Instead of finding Trey Callahan, they saw a pudgy older man wearing a priest's collar. He was sweeping broken glass off the floor. The front window had been broken. A brick was among the shards.
"Yes?"
he asked. Evelyn took the lead.
"We're with the Atlanta Police Department. We're looking for Trey Callahan."
The man seemed confused.
"So am I."
Amanda gathered they'd missed something.
"Callahan isn't here? Who do you think caused this mess?"
He indicated the broken glass.
"Trey was supposed to open the shelter last night. He didn't show up, so one of the girls threw a brick through the window."
He leaned against the broom.
"I'm sorry, I've never dealt with the police before. Are you gals secretaries? The officer who just left said he would need a typed statement."
Amanda suppressed a groan. The officer had been giving him the runaround.
"We're not secretaries. We're plainclothes detectives," Evelyn interrupted, sounding very sure of herself. "And we don't type statements. What's your name, sir?"
"Father Bailey. I work at the soup kitchen down the street."
He didn't match the descriptions they'd been given. The priest was only a few inches taller than Amanda.
"Are you the only one who works at the kitchen?"
"No, my associate does the cooking. Sometimes I help with the cleaning, but my main duties are to provide spiritual support."
He glanced at the clock on the wall.
"I'm actually late, so if you girls..."
Evelyn interrupted. "If you work at the soup kitchen, why are you here?"
"I was supposed to meet with Trey this morning. We coordinate once a month, talk about the girls, who might be in trouble, who to look out for."
"And you pulled in and saw the broken window?"
"And a room full of girls sleeping away the morning when they should have been locked out of the building."
He indicated the back room.
"Trey's office has been rifled. Probably one of the girls."
"Did any of them see anything?"
"I hate to be uncharitable, but none of them are particularly helpful unless it directly benefits themselves."
Amanda remembered.
"What about Callahan's girlfriend? She's training to be a nurse at Georgia Baptist."
He studied her for a moment.
"Yes, I called over there looking for her. Eileen Sapperson. They say she missed her shift last night, too."
Did the hospital have a home number for her?
She doesn't have a home line.
Do you mind if we... Amanda indicated Callahan's office. The priest shrugged. He resumed sweeping as they walked to the back of the room. The office had clearly been tossed, but Amanda wasn't sure whether the perpetrator was a junkie looking for money or a man trying to quickly leave town. Callahan's desk was cleared of all his personal items. No framed photo of his dog and girlfriend, no slinky, no funk posters, no transistor radio. There were a few joints smoked down to the last centimeter in the ashtray. The drawers hung open. Most important, the stack of typewriter pages was gone. Evelyn noticed it too.
Where's his manuscript?
I can't imagine a whore using it for anything but toilet paper.
Callahan got out of here fast. He must have taken the girlfriend.
On the same night Mary Halston was left dead at Techwood.
Coincidence?
Amanda didn't know anymore.
Let's go talk to the guy at the soup kitchen.
We can at least ask the priest his name. They walked back into the main room. The priest was gone.
Hello, Evelyn called, though they could see every corner of the room.
Amanda followed her outside. The sidewalk was empty. No one was in the parking lot. They even checked behind the building.
Well, at least he didn't lie to us.
That we know of.
Amanda walked back toward the Plymouth. The inside of the car was already baking. She turned the key in the ignition.
I'm so sick and tired of being in this car.
You never really see Columbo driving anywhere.
I guess Ironside doesn't count.
I'd like to see what Techwood Homes would make of a cripple in a bread truck.
Amanda pulled out onto the street.
Pepper Anderson just magically appears wherever she needs to be.
1 week she's a nurse at the hospital. Next week, she's racing on a speedboat. Then she's a go-go dancer. Then a flight attendant flirting with some dreamy pilot. Hey,
shut up.
Evelyn chuckled as she leaned her arm on the door. They were both quiet as Amanda drove the few blocks up to Juniper Street. She asked,
left, right?
Pick one.
Amanda turned left. She slowed the car, checking each building on the left as Evelyn scanned the right. They were almost to Pine Street when Evelyn said, "That must be it." The building was derelict, nothing to indicate it was a church, except the large wooden cross stuck in the small patch of yard. It was painted black. Someone had thought to put nails where Jesus's hands and feet would have been. Little red dots of paint indicated his suffering.
What a dump, Evelyn said.
She was right. The brick facade was crumbling. There were large vertical cracks in the mortar. Graffiti riddled the stoop, which was constructed of dry stacked cinder blocks. Two of the four downstairs windows were boarded over, but the corresponding windows up top seemed intact. They both got out of the car and headed toward the building. Amanda felt a breeze from a car passing in the street. It was an Atlanta police cruiser. The blue lights flashed once in greeting, but the driver didn't stop. The front door to the soup kitchen was open. Amanda smelled herbs and spices as soon as she crossed the threshold. Picnic tables filled the room. Plates and bowls were laid out, napkins and spoons.
No sharp objects, Evelyn noted.
Probably wise.
Amanda raised her voice.
Hello? Just a minute.
A gruff voice called from the back. They heard pots clattering, heavy footsteps across the floor. The man came out of the kitchen. Amanda felt gripped by an unexpected fear. They'd learned at the academy that the average door was 6 feet 8 inches high and 30 inches wide. It was a good gauge to estimate a person's height and weight. The man filled the kitchen doorway. His shoulders were almost as wide as the space between the jams. His head nearly touched the top of the opening. He smiled. His bottom tooth was crooked. His lips were full.
"May I help you, officers?"
Both of them stood frozen for a second. Amanda reached into her purse, found her badge. She showed it to the man, although he already knew they were cops. Amanda just wanted to say the words.
"I'm Detective Wagner.
This is Detective Mitchell. Please. He gestured to the table. Have a seat.
He waited politely for them to sit, then took the bench across from them. Again, Amanda couldn't help but make comparisons. The man was almost as wide as both of them put together. Just the sight of his hands gripped together on the table was menacing. He could probably easily wrap his finger around their necks. Evelyn took out her notebook. She asked, "What's your name, sir?"
"James Ulster."
"Do you know Trey Callahan?" He sighed. His voice was so deep that it came out as more of a growl.
"Is this about the money he stole?"
"He stole money?" Amanda asked, though it was obvious he had.
"Father Bailey is more mindful of public relations than I am,"
Ulster explained.
"One of the donors on the board noticed that some funds were missing. Trey was to be called to task first thing this morning. I gather he had other plans."
Amanda remembered the phone call Callahan had gotten yesterday when they were in his office. The man had said a donor was on the line. She asked,
"They're certain it was Trey who was embezzling money?" "I'm afraid so."
Ulster rested his hand on either side of the bench. He was slumped down, probably out of habit. Such a large man would be accustomed to people feeling intimidated. Though considering he ran a soup kitchen for Atlanta's huddled masses, his size was probably more of an advantage than not. Amanda asked,
"Do you have any idea where Callahan might have gone?"
Ulster shook his head.
"I believe he has a fiancée."
They would have to go to Georgia Baptist next, though Amanda was fairly certain that was a dead end.
"You're friends with Mr. Callahan." "Did he say that?"
Amanda lied.
"He said that you were."
"Is that wrong?"
"We had theological discussions. We talked about many different things."
"Shakespeare?" Amanda asked. It was a stab in the dark, but it worked.
"Sometimes,"
Ulster admitted.
"Many authors of the 17th century wrote in a coded language. It was not a time when subversives were rewarded."
"As in Hamlet?" Evelyn asked.
"That's not the best example, but yes."
"What about Ophelia?" Ulster's tone took a sharp edge.
"She was a liar and a whore."
Amanda felt Evelyn stiffen beside her. She said,
"You seem sure of that." "I'm sorry, but I find the subject matter tiresome. Trey was obsessed with the story. You couldn't often have a conversation without him quoting some obscure line."
That seemed true enough. "Do you know why?"
"It's no secret that he was particularly interested in fallen women. Redemption, salvation. I'm sure you were treated to one of his lectures on how all of these girls can be saved. He was quite adamant about it, and took it very personally when they failed."
Ulster shook his head.
"And of course they do fail. They continually fail. It's in their nature."
Evelyn asked, "Did you ever see Trey acting inappropriately with the girls?"
"I wasn't often at the mission. My work is here. It wouldn't surprise me to learn that he availed himself. He stole money from a charitable organization. Why would he stop at exploiting fallen women?"
"Did you ever see him angry?"
"Not with my own eyes, but I heard that he had quite a temper. Some of the girls mentioned that he could be violent."
Amanda glanced down at Evelyn's notebook. She wasn't writing down any of this. Maybe she was thinking the same thing as Amanda. Trey Callahan was probably stoned out of his mind most of his waking hours. It was hard to imagine him experiencing anger, let alone acting on it. Of course, they hadn't pegged him for a thief either. Evelyn said, "Trey Callahan was writing a book."
"Yes."
Ulster drew out the sibilant.
"His opus. It wasn't very good."
"You read it?"
"A few pages. Callahan was more suited for the job he had than the job he wanted."
He smiled at them.
"So many people would better know peace if they just accepted the plans the Lord has for them."
Amanda got the feeling that Ulster was talking to them directly. Evelyn must have felt the same, Her tone was curt when she asked, "What exactly do you do here, Mr. Ulster?"
"Well, we feed people, obviously. Breakfast is at 6 in the morning. The lunch hour begins at noon. You'll find the tables start to fill up well before then."
"Those are your only meals?"
"No, we provide dinner as well. That begins at 5 and is over promptly at 7.
"And then they leave?"
"Most do. Some of them stay the evening. There are 20 beds upstairs. A shower, though the hot water is not reliable. Women only, of course."
He made to stand.